Hello, and welcome to Tabletop Game Talk, On Topic, a show where we talk about tabletop gaming topics of all kinds. I'm one of your hosts, Fletcher.
I'm Kitty.
And I'm Chris.
Today we're talking about role-playing games versus role-play games. Basically, we're talking about the different role-playing games and why one may appeal more than another. We'll also talk about what we like and dislike about different role-playing systems. We all know there are a lot of good board games in the world, but would you believe there are almost as many role-playing games? There are, and we're going to talk about all of them, or not.
But before we talk about all of them, because we're gonna, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, George, Gia, Adam Harrison, the SGC, and Thomas Accioretti. And thank you to our newest patron, Tim, I'm going to say Shucker. All right, and a huge thank you to all our other patrons as well. Okay, we're recording late again, and I keep saying that we're going to like actually stream one of these at some point for the patrons, but we keep moving our recording date. But this time we had a good excuse. There was a Game of Thrones episode that we had to watch, so we could not possibly record on Sunday night.
It was the first one of the new season. The next ones we can record on Sunday, but it was the first one of the new season, so I had to watch it.
Hey, Kitty, are you Game of Thrones?
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
I'm too cool for it. No, I got... I was really into the books, and then I got mad at the books, and then I watched some of the show, but then I got mad at the show.
See, I read the first like three chapters of one of the books and said, nah, I'll just go to the show. It's fine.
Well, the show didn't exist when I started reading the books.
The books didn't exist in my mind until the show.
Yeah, I finished all of the current, or not all the current ones. I guess there's one new one now, but I read the first four books before the show ever existed.
I just think it's funny that they decided they needed to finish the series. The books are never going to be finished. So they're like, okay, and now we're just going to split from the books. And what happens in the show is completely unrelated to anything in the books because the show's going to be done before the books are.
Well, I hear now he's trying to stretch out the show longer and longer. So, haha, to everyone still in the show.
I don't think that's going to happen. It sounds to me like it had a pretty solid ending. At least the thing that I watched that I felt was the coolest is the cast did like a... Like the cast reminisces about the show type of things, like 5-minute interviews. There's maybe 15 of them. Those were actually really cool. Apparently, it was a really fun show to film for a decade. All right,
talking we about could actually with say too many characters and a lot of plot.
Yeah, you know what we should do? Because I went into my game store last week, and he had a counter full of all the Game of Thrones themed games. So when the season's over, which I think there's only 7 weeks in the season, right? There's 7 episodes in this last
season? I think there's only 6, actually.
Well, whenever the season's over, maybe we'll do an episode that's just Game of Thrones books and not books, Game of Thrones-based games. That could fill several episodes, I'm sure.
Game of Thrones-based books, a.k.a. the books, a.k.a. welcome to Bookcast.
Bookcast. Tabletop book talk?
We can have a crossover with fresh baked books.
Oh, that could work. And now we have to cook things from the Game of Thrones series. There's actually a few of them. There's some baking references in Game of Thrones. Anyway, we should talk about
a cookbook.
Let's talk about games.
All right.
Let's talk about role playing games. And I should put the Song of Ice and Fire as a role playing game that we can talk about because that is a system that exists and it. Is a thing. Oh, I didn't even put that in the. I'm adding to the right notes right now. Licensed RPGs such as Game of Thrones, Star Trek, Star Wars, Star Everything, all kinds of stuff.
Well, let's start at the very beginning.
Okay, what's that?
Dungeons and Dragons.
1974, the year I was born. Gary Gygax and David, I always forget his last name, I think it's Arnest or something along those lines, decided to take their chainmail game, which was a tabletop miniatures war game, and put a story behind it and create a game called TSR and got really, really popular. Then in the early 80s, the Satanic Panic happened, which was essentially the exact over... I actually don't know what the... origin of it is, but it was kind of like an Onion article of some sort.
They did a great episode about it on that podcast you always talk about, Stuff You Should Know.
Yes.
So if you're interested,
they did one on the Satanic Panic. Yeah,
they did.
And there was a reason for it. There was like an origin for it. But I remember like the Harry Potter one was an Onion article that then got picked up by like the extreme Christian right that Harry Potter was satanic. And they were citing this Onion article as if it were factual. A similar thing happened for D&D in the early 80s, which then kind of took TSR into a spiral. But in that time, in the late 70s, early 80s, tons and tons of other role-playing games appeared. The late 80s, early 90s was a lull in role-playing. And then late 90s, in the last, I'd say, 15 years or so, the role-playing games have really made a huge comeback and are bigger now than they've ever been in the past, which is why we're doing three episodes on it, because it is that interesting. So, what is your favorite? Well, Kitty, how many different role-playing games have you played, role-playing systems?
I have played Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. I've played Pathfinder, and I have played Savage Worlds.
All right. And you never played in my 4th Edition game. You were just,
no,
you just cooked for
I
that
one. I was in the room.
Yes. Fletcher, what about you?
I have played Dungeons & Dragons 2.5, 3, 4, and 5, and then also Shadowrun. I don't know which edition, but whatever was current in like the early 2000s.
And I would not know that one for sure. Also, I think, do you mean 3.5 or what? Dungeons & Dragons 2.5?
Maybe I mean 3. Was it 3.5?
Yeah, there was a 3 and a 3.5. Dungeons & Dragons 2 was just called Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, which actually Dungeons & Dragons 1 was also, there was Dungeons & Dragons, and then there was Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, and then Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And then TSR went out of business. Wizards of the Coast was flushed with money because they had done Magic the Gathering and said, hey, we'll buy Dungeons & Dragons from you. And then they did 3.0. Within a year, they had 3.5 out because 3.0 was very, very broken.
I thought like Advanced Dungeons & Dragons was like 2.5. Which one had Thaco?
First edition and second edition.
Okay, so I think Thaco. It was a second edition or like a revamped second edition, because I remember playing with Thaco, and then 3.0 came out and it was like, oh, done with this crap.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, the second edition had like the orange spines, or yes, the hardcover books with the orange spines, and Thaco went away. For those unfamiliar, Thaco was the acronym for 2-hit armor class 0. And in order to roll to hit, you had to look up your target number on a table or know how to do the math in your head. There was some way to like
the
know
math wasn't
how to,
that hard. You just had to know what your Thaco was and what the armor class was. Basically, it was needlessly complicated that the more armor you had, your armor would go down and like yep. zero. You could have 0 and then -1 armor, as opposed to just having everything additive. They had like armor was subtractive, and then like your 2-hit was like additive.
And it made it for a very confusing system. But it actually was a legacy mechanism from the chainmail system. Because apparently when you do miniatures, when they were doing their miniature games, negative armor classes were better than positive armor classes. And that just kind of carried over into Dungeons & Dragons for the first couple editions. So those who like Thaco, though, are like, no, it totally makes sense and it's totally fine. And positive armor classes are way better.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense.
And that is just the Dungeons & Dragons edition, like those editions. And I could go really deep into this. I think we've talked a little bit. We did an episode on Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition. It's back then in the catalog someplace if you want more details. And
did
I probably went into a little history there. I'm pretty sure we did.
I think we did like an intro to role-playing games featuring Dungeons & Dragons. We did like a 5th ed side chat too, where we did our actual play for one episode.
Yeah, and that is also in our stream, so you can listen to our, I think we did two parts of it. It was like kind of a learn the rules, so we went over the characters and the rules, and then the second part was like a 1-hour intro adventure, which we got a lot of emails saying, hey, when's the next one, when are you going to go, when are you going to continue. Listen next week and maybe we'll have some other things to talk about that. But yeah, so Dungeons & Dragons started it all, but almost immediately there were other role-playing games. And Dungeons & Dragons is a fantasy-based role-playing, very Tolkien-esque.
Yeah, like elves. Well, original Dungeons & Dragons was almost exclusively Tolkien.
Yeah, and all Dungeons & Dragons worlds have been basically based off that. So the elves, dwarves, they're halflings in Dungeons & Dragons, not hobbits. But originally, I believe they may have even been called hobbits. I don't know if it was published as such, but the Tolkien people said, nope, nope, nope. Elves and dwarves, fine. That's not original. We didn't make that. But hobbits, you can't use that. So then Dungeons and Dragons immediately went to, fine, we don't have hobbits. We have halflings. And they're short and they are very dexterous.
They're
just like hobbits. They can hide. And depending on the edition, they even have big furry feet. So, yeah.
They almost always have an inn.
They're very hospitable little half people.
I guess they don't always have an inn, but when you walk into an inn, there's almost always a halfling behind the bar.
Well, you gotta have a halfling behind the bar.
Obviously.
I mean, just the way that works. All right. So I don't know much about the Shadowrun role-playing game, except for what I've read as far as it being essentially three systems in one. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the Shadowrun role-playing game, Fletcher.
So I haven't played too much Shadowrun, but I actually really do like it, and I like the setting a lot. It's kind of set as a, I don't know, like noir, what's the word I'm thinking of?
Cyber or something?
Like cyberpunk setting. There are like elves and other races and stuff like that. But really like what gets me is like the cool cyberpunk setting, and it has like two unique mechanisms. One is that it's all based on like a D6 system, so you only need six-sided dice. And the other is that unlike Dungeons and Dragons, there's kind of you can do like enhancements to your characters to make them more cybernetic, or you can like refrain from doing that to your characters so they're more like biological. And that adds another dynamic into the game, because like if you add more cybernetics to your character, they can do advanced and augmented things, but then like they are more susceptible to like other types of attacks, whereas if you're more biologic, you're susceptible to like all kinds of, you know, normal biologic things, but you're not susceptible to like cybernetic and like other EMP attacks. So I always thought that was kind of like an interesting kind of dynamic in the game, that you can choose to like go one way or the other, or like a balanced approach with your character.
So, and I want to bring up a few differences be around these, but just quickly covering kind of the basics of a few different games so that we can use them as talking points. Katie, why don't you talk to us about Savage Worlds?
Savage Worlds, the setting we played in was the Slipstream setting.
Yep.
So it was a very pulpy sci-fi setting.
Like 50s pulp sci-fi, yeah.
Buck Rogers, yeah, like... laser guns and that kind of stuff. And that one, you, trying to remember, it's been so long since we played this. This one, you don't upgrade your skills so much as you like buy a higher level of die. Everyone starts with, if you're skilled in something, you have a D6, I think.
And it's a D4, D6, D8.
Yeah. So you can get all the way up to D12. I know. Yep. So. Yep. I think D12 is the highest it goes, and so you're buying, basically using your skill points and experience, a higher die for your skill to roll. And the thing I remember most about this system was bennies. You could hand these out. Either the GM could use them, or Chris let other players give them too, for good role-playing, excellent character-driven adventure driving fun things that characters did. You could gain these and you could spend them later to re-roll bad dice, or was it to add a bonus? I can't even remember how they worked, but I remember it was so much fun to give them out. I think it was a re-roll. Yeah.
Yep. And then the other thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
With Savage Worlds is exploding dice. So if you ever rolled the highest value on a die, you took that value and then added another die roll.
Yeah.
So if you rolled a D6 and you rolled a 6, you'd roll again. So you rolled a 5, you rolled a total of 11 on your 1D6. But if you kept rolling 6s, you could get, you know,
huge
basically
numbers.
Infinite.
Very unlikely, though.
Yep. Fletcher, did Shadowrun have levels, or did you, it was like a point buy, or how did you, like mechanically, how did you increase your character?
I think it was levels and point, you know, it was so long ago, I just remember really liking it. Lot and I didn't get to play that often because my friends were like more interested in the Dungeons and Dragons world, and not that I wasn't, but I always wanted to play more Shadowrun, and I just never really got the chance.
So to round out this a little bit, I actually don't recall, depending on the edition of Shadowrun, I I don't believe Shadowrun is level-based, but I could be wrong depending on the edition. Savage Worlds is definitely not level-based. Dungeons & Dragons is. So just to back up for those who have been listening for the last 10 minutes and are like, okay, I have no idea what these guys are saying. A role-playing game, they definitely have rules. And each role-playing game will be more or That's less...
Really, all they are is a set of rules that you sort play of, by yes. at the table.
Yep, and they'll be more or less, I don't want to say mathy, but maybe codified. So the more strict the rule system is, the more it's going to feel like it's a board game. Like a board game has a very, very strict rule set. There's no room for interpretation in most board games. In a role-playing game, you can have something that's incredibly strict. D&D 4th edition was a very, very much, they tried to answer every possible thing you could do with a rule so that, you know, the DM and the players were on the same footing. Where you go over to something
which
like...
is very similar to Pathfinder.
Yes. Yep. Actually, Pathfinder, which is based off of Dungeons & Dragons 3.5, also very, very mechanical based where...
There's a rule for everything that you want to do in the world.
Yep. Which can, A, give you that equal footing. So you can argue with your DM over rules, saying, no, this is how it works. And B, it can really complicate the system so that you spend most of your time talking about rules in a lot of cases.
Yeah. I always remember like looking at 3 or 3.5 and it's like, rules for grappling. And I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah. Yep. Grappling rules are an actually just an inside joke of the industry, the grappling rules for 3.5. So Pathfinder did simplify the grappling rules a little bit. That was one of the things that Pathfinder did when they revised the 3.5 system, which some refer to as 3.75. That's what Pathfinder is Dungeons & Dragons 3.75. Savage Worlds. But anyway, so in Dungeons & Dragons, you work on levels. You're going to get a certain number of experience points or advancement milestones or whatever the leveling, you know, check mark is. When you hit that amount, you level up and you're going to get some extra abilities or some more hit points or better chances to hit or something along those lines. Levels are really commonly used in role-playing games in a box as well. Actually, it's not that commonly used, but they are used enough. I think that the other system, the non-leveling system, which is the more trait-based system, is how Savage Worlds works. Savage Worlds doesn't have any levels at all. There are still milestones where you will be able to choose a new ability or new trait of some sort.
They're mostly like point-buy kind of things, where you hit a milestone and you get so many points to spend.
Well, and Savage Worlds, I think... Well, you might get points, but they're very big points.
Yeah.
So 1 point is an advancement. 2 points might be a really cool advancement, but it's not like a macro or micro level points.
No, it's 1 point gets you something. Like you will only get 2-3 points maybe to spend, and they do big things.
Right. And this is synonymous with things like if you're playing Pandemic Legacy, getting a sticker to put on your character.
Yeah.
So, and it's the similar things in Savage Worlds is like the type of traits. It's like, I'm going to buy this ability where I'm really good with laser guns, and now I get +2 to hit with laser guns, and I get the ability to spend an additional action to aim, which increases my die to something. I made that up, but I wouldn't be surprised if that exists. something along those lines. So that is your leveling system versus your trait system. Now you have your full point buy system, which is something like the hero system or champions or GURPS. GURPS is the generic role-playing universal something play system or something like that. But these two systems are very much point buy. I used to play champions in high school and it is a superhero role-playing game. And you would get somewhere in the neighborhood of like 250 to 350 points to spend, and everything was points. It cost you 1 point to get an extra point of strength, cost you 3 points for a point of dexterity, cost you 5 points for a 1d6 energy blast. And yes, these are actual numbers because I think that's genetic memory at this point. I played it so much. I used to sit in math class and just make superheroes up in the back of math. I think that math was more complicated than the stuff we were learning in school. So those are the three basic kinds of character development. And then you have your character development that isn't really any of those things. And then you start getting into things like Fate. Fate is another role-playing system where character creation is essentially along the lines of tell me three things about your character. I'm very fast. I have great I have like super hearing and I limp. It's usually a couple of good things and a bad thing. And those are considered things like aspects. And in that type of system, you could get more aspects to your character as you're playing, but essentially you're not, you know, Fate does have dice, but the dice have two pluses, two minuses, and two blanks, and you roll two dice. So your average roll in Fate is zero, and maybe you get a plus two or a minus two in the extremes. So that's how you kind of evaluate things in Fate. But Fate is a very story-based system where it's like, well, I'm really good at hearing. So because I'm in a situation where, these guys are whispering, it's across the room, because I'm good at hearing, I know I can like hear what they're saying. And then the GM will say, yes, you're going to get some extra bonus on your roll because you're good at hearing. And then you roll your dice. Now on the other side, it's like, oh, but now I heard that they're going to go, kill the ambassador in the back room. So I'm going to run after him, but I have a limp. So I'm not going to be able to get there in time. And the GM will be like, yes, you're right. That's great. You used a negative aspect on yourself. Here's a fate token, which is similar to a Benny. And because you were willing to advance the story with a disadvantage for your character, I'm going to give you something that you can use to advance the story in a positive way later. And Fate's a very much back and forth collaborative storytelling system.
Is Fate related to Vampire the Masquerade?
No, that's another system.
Very similar systems, though, are they not?
No, well, Fate is probably
very story driven, much more than math driven.
Yeah, well, you could say that role playing games have essentially two extremes. One that is the rules based systems, the math based systems. The simulations are the best way to describe those. They're trying to simulate what can be done in the world in a gamified way. The others are the story based systems. Fate would be much more on the story-based side. Pathfinder would be much more on the math side. Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition is probably still much more on the math side, but not quite as much as Pathfinder is. And then
I was going to say, compared to Pathfinder, but something like Powered by the Apocalypse system
is very much on the story side of the system.
I would say it goes a little towards the middle because you are making choices based entirely on dice rolls where you get bonuses added to them.
Yes.
But those consequences are all story consequences, not mechanical consequences.
Yep. So let's talk by the Apocalypse just very briefly. The way this particular role-playing game works is your character is essentially a list of moves. And moves have triggers. So something has to happen and then you can decide to use a move. And that move will have a varying number of results based on a 2d6 roll. And it's a fuzzy roll. So I think it's if you get a 6 plus, it's a success. But if it's a 10 plus, it's a super success. And you can get less than, it's a failure. And
it's less than 6 is a failure. 6 to 10, I think, is a mixed success. And a 10 plus is a success.
Yep. So, and what a move essentially is, it'll say something like, someone attacks you. Oh, I'm going to use my dodge move. The trigger is that someone's attacking you. The dodge is the move you're making. Now, that's like a mechanical one, but you can also say someone tries to charm you. It's like, oh, well, I'm resistant to charm, so I'm going to use my resist charm move. And for that, I'm going to roll my things and whatever. So if I resist really great, I can like, not only do I resist this charm, I turn it around and I charm them or something along those lines. It's meant to be a much more fluid conversational system. So something happens, and then in response, you do something else. But they're still very story-based, and the dice are there just to kind of help you and the GM decide what happens, as opposed to everything being like an absolute of like, this is just what happens.
Yeah, it feels like something happens at the table, and then it's like almost a choose-your-own-adventure, and the dice tell you which page to go to.
Kind of. Yes.
You have like three branches and like the dice are going to tell you, oh, you're going to take one of these three paths.
Yep. Because some people will call something like Dungeons & Dragons a binary system, where in Dungeons & Dragons, the core, and well, let's talk about the core mechanics. We've kind of been talking about it in a roundabout way. Dungeons & Dragons, Pathfinder, the core mechanic is you roll a 20-sided die and you're going to add some modifier to it. You're going to compare it to a number that you need to get equal to or better to pass, or you're going to fail otherwise. It's binary. You pass or you fail. A lot of people don't like that whole binary linear success. So a lot of people will shy away from that, what we referred to collectively as D20 systems, where it's just this linear, every number on the die is essentially a 5% chance to succeed. A plus one is a plus 5%. In Dungeon World, it's a little bit more granular. You have three or four, depending on, you know, shades of success. Fate has also is more granular. You can actually succeed with complications or fail with advantages or things like that. So there's actually mixed variability. The Fantasy Flight Star Wars role-playing game is like that too. They don't do real dice at all. It's a custom set of dice that has completely unique symbols on it. So it's like you roll it and essentially it's like reading tea leaves to figure out what happened. You get better at it over time, but it's like you can succeed or fail. There can be complications or advantages or something in there. And it makes for very interesting storytelling based on what's going on with the dice without it being just a pass-fail number system. So you have all these different ranges of role-playing games. And then you have, I'm going to throw this out there as a potential role-playing game just to kind of round it out. And that's Fiasco. You guys familiar with this one?
No.
Only from the notes you wrote here.
So Fiasco is a game that's based on like a Coen Brothers movie. So apparently these movies, like Fargo. Mm-hmm. So it starts out in some way where you kind of like set up the scene and then something terrible happens and then you get resolutions to your characters, right? So it's like this arc. And Fiasco is meant to be played in a single session. It doesn't have a GM. It's one of the few role-playing games, if you can call it that, I think you can, that is a GM-less game. And the way it works is when you create your characters, you're actually creating not a character for you, but you're creating relationships with the other three people at the table. So it's always a four-player game, and usually. And like if we were sitting around a table, Fletcher and I would come up with a how are our characters related? Then Kitty and I would come up with a how are our characters related? And then Kitty and Fletcher would come up with how their characters are related. And then we would come up with, you know, an item that we share between us and different aspects that we share between all of these different things. And the story is told based on that. And every person goes around and they either can create a scene or finish a scene. So if I start the scene, I can set it up. It's like, okay, I'm in a bar. You walk in. We start talking about the heist that we're going to do. Now, I set up the scene, but I don't get to finish it. The rest of the table has to finish that scene. So, and then there's like a role. Improv. Most role-playing is improv in some way. Yeah, but this is
even more improv. It's like yes and an adventure.
Yep. Well, and to make it more interesting, so you do roll dice to kind of see what the results are, but you can also win this game. So one person will come away at the end with like the best roll of, you know, because you can get negatives and positive dice or so as you're going through this black dice and white dice. And depending on how much you get of one or the other, the final climactic scene will have everyone rolling these dice. And whoever rolls the most, nobody that I know ever actually have a winner. It's usually just a system to allow for storytelling. But that's Fiasco. And Fiasco, actually, there's tables that you're going to roll on to get, they call them playbooks, I believe. And maybe they're not playbooks. That's powered by the apocalypse. But there's little books that come along with, like, I want to do a sci-fi noir version of Fiasco. You're going to get a bunch of tables that help you generate characters based in that system. But they're always something that's bad. Like when you walk away, your characters are usually in a worse situation than when you started because it's based on a Coen movie. But yeah, so lots and lots of different role-playing game systems. I did say we're talking about all of them, right? Yeah. All right. So a couple others that I want to bring in. I want to bring in Terrence wrote in because he also noticed that I didn't have an input thread on these episodes. And I don't know why I'm not putting an input thread on here. For some reason, I just feel like, I don't know. In my mind, I'm like, nobody would be interested in contributing to this. It's probably not true, but I apologize.
Probably not. Yeah.
Yeah. But Terrence took it upon himself to write in. He's like, one role-playing system I'd like for you guys to think about is Cortex Plus. They use this for the Firefly role-playing game. He's like, I don't like role-playing games, but I enjoy this one as it focuses on the narrative and does not get bogged down in a lot of mechanisms. My biggest question on any role-playing game is how does the GM know how to set the threat level for any given task that the party has to face? Cortex does it a good job by helping the DM set the stakes. The modules are set up as episodes like a TV show. They set the scene, run three acts, and wrap up. Even a non-role-playing fan like myself is able to run a session. So this goes along with, you know, that story side of role-playing games versus mechanical sides of role-playing games. So that was a lot of me talking. You guys, thoughts?
So I know it is a lot harder to run these games as the GM than it is to play in them as a character, I think. And a lot of this, you know, the more mechanics there are, usually the harder it is for the GM to set up. But there is generally a separate manual for the rule books. There's like the player's guide, and then there is the GM guide. And they will give you things like, add up your party level of characters, number of characters. It'll give you a number, and it will give you a table of like a difficulty rating. And then all of the monsters that you face have these numbers, and you try to total them up so that you're within a range for an easy, difficult, or extremely difficult scenario that your players are going to encounter.
Yep. And each role-playing game will do this a little bit differently.
Yeah.
And really, it depends on the size of the role-playing game, and by size, I mean like the number of books printed, whether or not there's a completely separate game master's guide versus player's guide. But a lot of the bigger ones do have separate guides.
Yeah, the ones I'm most familiar with the GM side is Pathfinder and 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons. And those ones definitely each have their own, if not one book, multiple books.
Yeah. All the other books are usually add-ons, though.
Yeah.
Well, and even if they don't have a separate GM guide, a lot of times games, at least I'm going to say supported games versus one-off games. A one-off game is, it's a book that was printed and it's, you know, somebody had a, it was a passion project for someone, and it's a single book and it never has any extra books published for it. Supported games are those that you see a new material come out, you know, every few months or every year or 2 years or something along those lines. And supported games will oftentimes have settings. So if you have a generic game, you'll have settings books that come out. So Dungeons and Dragons has a ton of these, like settings, you know, you're in the Forgotten Realms, or you're in Dark Sun or Eberron, or the world, description of the world. You may have adventures or adventure paths. So Pathfinder does a lot of, like, 6-book adventure paths that you can take your characters through. Or Dungeons & Dragons does, here's a single thick book that is an adventure that's going to take you, you know, 2 years to run through. So it's a ton of content in one. Then you have modules, which are, well, adventures, which old school call them modules, which are just like a night of adventuring. So it's a single adventure, which are all considered kind of supplements. Then you might have character supplements, and like, here's all these extra things you can do on characters. Shadowrun has a lot of stuff like that. Depending on the type of character you are, you might get a book just for, you know, if you're, is it hacking or jacking or like plugging into the cyber network in Shadowrun? I read a Shadowrun book once. But you'll have like handbooks on just how to do all of that. And yeah, it's definitely the hardest thing to do when you're playing a role-playing game is to find someone to run that game for you. Because as the game master, you really have to be way more invested than the players, because you need to read all the books. You don't have to, but it helps a lot if you do, because somebody needs to take the reins and run with the system. And if you don't have someone to do that, and it's usually the GM, it just, the game will never get started.
The best groups are where everyone does that, though.
I've never met one of those.
You've never met one of those.
Yeah. And I've run a lot, and my friends aren't slackers.
I guess not, but everyone at the table does it. But when you have, you know, 2 or 3 people who, if not read all the books, have at least read the core books, more than one book, that's where it gets fun, where you have a few different people who can stick up for the party and argue the rules and kind of be the, you know, the defense attorney against the GM. That's always my fun part.
Adversarial player. Yep. Yep.
That's you don't want to be adversarial. I don't think that's right. I think that you want to have somebody, though, who's, because you don't want to, you know, just fight all the time, but you want to, you know, discuss in a nice way. Maybe I just like to argue. My parents are both attorneys. I don't know if I've talked about that enough.
There's a term for it called rules lawyer.
Yeah. So I tend to argue very, you know, passionately for my rules. I love rules. So that's just me as a player. I'm so excited to be that person at your table, Chris, all the time.
Yeah. Well, and there's nothing wrong with it. So I spend a lot of time GMing tables with tons and tons of different levels of players. So when I was DMing Adventurers League and I was going to conventions and DMing and stuff, you meet a lot of different types of players. And some of them are, you have your power gamers. They're the ones that just want to show up and get their experience and level their character and get on it. So they're just kind of grinding, you know, through a real life role-playing game, I guess real-life in-person role-playing game versus a video game. But they're just grinding the character up. You have people that are brand new to the system and have, like, I don't know how to role-play. I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm like, those are the best because they're the ones that actually play the game the best because they will, you can ask them, what do you want to do? Don't worry about what your character sheet says. Don't worry about what the rules are. Tell me what you want to do, and I will tell you how you get there.
Yeah.
Because like, that's
coming more than six sides?
Yeah. Exactly. Those are the, yeah, it's like, what, wait, just roll the roundest one and add this number to it is, you know, roll the one that looks like a golf ball. That's the one you want to roll. But that's kind of how I think people should be playing role-playing games is tell me what you want to do and we'll make the rules work for the story we want to tell. And some games are more catered to that and others you have to just kind of fudge the rules a little bit to let that happen. But you don't even, like I say, I don't have to fudge them that much. Most rule systems give the DM a lot of control that are, quote unquote, within the rules to make fun happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm always a big fan, too, though, of finding the thing that just makes the game more fun as a player for me. Things like, I'm trying to remember what character this was, but I think a sorceress. Sorcerer is not fun to say. I like sorceress. And there was like a wild magic table. And whenever I did magic, I would roll the die to see what effect it had on the wild magic table. And just like that part of the rules was so much fun for me to have that table and just create utter chaos in every scenario was the best. Yeah,
and because I knew you liked that, I broke the rules for you because as written, you only roll on that table. I think if you roll a 20. There's like a 5% chance that you're ever going to roll on that table. And I'm like, you know something? Whatever. If you hit, you can roll on the table whenever you want. You just have to take the consequences because some are good and some are bad, which took that thing that you found were fun and like, let's make it even more wild or crazy. As long as everyone's having fun, I don't care. Otherwise, this doesn't come up almost ever. And you're like, but I'm a wild magic sorcerer. Why can't I do my wild magic?
And that's the sign of somebody working within the rules and a good GM to break the rules to find where it's fun for the whole table. And sometimes I do think D&D does that where they come up with these really cool ideas and then say like, and it's going to happen when something really cool happens. It's like, well, no, I don't want to bother like spending all my points to do this thing for it to maybe be cool, like sort of when I get to like 12th level or something, you know, it kind of dulls itself initially. So I think a good GM is willing to make things flexible to bump up the fun, especially at early levels. It can really feel like, I don't know what I'm doing. This is boring.
Well, what's interesting too,
I have six hit points.
Because somebody's listening and is like, oh, if my DM let me do this or this, I could just create the most broken character and then whatever. So the rules are there so the DM can kind of hide behind them as well, saying, no, if you use wild magic all the time, you're going to break the system. But I know that that's not what your intent is. Your intent isn't to break the system. Your intent is to create a little chaos around your character because that's what you want your character to be. It's very, very different.
I wish I could pull up this table right now because I don't think you could do anything on purpose with this table.
No,
it's like growing and shrinking and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's like 100 different things that can literally 100
it's different things. It's literally, yeah.
But the point is,
I'm Googling it right now.
Well, you guys are bringing up that table. The point is, when you're DMing, it is okay to let the players have more freedom as long as the players aren't trying to take that freedom to, I don't know, like give them an inch, they take a mile type of thing. And that's one of the things I have to be very careful of, is making a ruling for fun and then making that be like a standard thing. I know one game, one of our players, he really loved the create water cantrip. So you can cast this thing as much as you want.
Oh my gosh.
And you can create a gallon of water.
Seriously?
And he just wanted to flood the world with this cantrip.
So many fights had over this cantrip. I can't even tell you. Like, arguing about how much water this would actually make, what you could do with this water. Like, seriously, so much time at the table.
So eventually I had to make a ruling and saying, okay, this is how this mechanically works. You can't have anything that has an effect more than this. And no, you cannot create a gallon of water in the dragon's lungs and drown it. No, no, you can't do that.
So let's see. If you roll a 17 to 18, you grow a beard made of feathers, which remains until you sneeze, at which point the feathers explode out from your face.
Yeah. I'm looking at the same list right now, too.
47-48, a unicorn controlled by the DM appears in a space within 5 feet of you, then disappears 1 minute later. Oh, that's a lot of rounds, 1 minute.
That is 10 rounds.
19 to 20, you cast grease centered on yourself.
Oh, boy. 75-76, you glow with a bright light in a 30-foot radius for the next minute. Any creature that ends its turn within 5 feet of you is blinded until the end of its next turn. These are so fun. This was such a great character.
These are the kinds of things that can make it fun. Now, you can also limit it where I'm like, okay, I want you to be able to do it, but maybe it doesn't trigger more than once every 5 minutes. So, you know, you're not every time you're doing something, you're not re-rolling on the table. But again, it's that rule of fun versus rules as written, which you can do for any role-playing game. Any role-playing game, you can modify so it's fun for your group. But then again, just be aware that there are hundreds upon hundreds of role-playing games out there. So maybe that's what you're looking for. You're not like, I don't really like the way D&D plays, but some of these other games sound like they might be really interesting. And I think that would work out really well. Licensed games. Well, actually anything more just in general on the generic concepts before we jump into licensed games, because I think this is another completely new subject by itself.
I mean, we could talk forever, but I think we've covered the basics pretty well.
Yeah. Well, we did say that we would talk about the things we liked or didn't like about role-playing systems. So let's just quickly focus on D&D, because we've all played D&D. D&D 5th edition. Is there something specific in D&D 5th edition that you guys don't like? Or is it the perfect game?
I can't think of things that I don't like off the top of my head. Because it's such an open-ended kind of a system, I feel like you can kind of take it as rules-heavy and fiddly or as open as the GM wants it to be. You can really enforce rules or let it be more free-form. You can do grid combat. You can do theater of the mind. It's very loose in that kind of a way. So it's hard for me to kind of pinpoint my hard and fast feelings on it because it kind of depends on the game played in the world.
So, and that could be a pro and a con. The pro being it's a very modular game system. There's a lot of optional rules in the DM's guide that allows you to cater the game to be what you want it to be. And in another way, there's a lot of optional rules. So depending on who you're playing with, those optional rules could potentially be things that you like or don't like, depending on your DM. So this is a conversation you need to have with your group. Again, we've referred to it kind of like a session zero. So the very first time you get together as a group, you create characters and you set down, here are the rules that we're going to be playing by. Here are my house rules. Here's what we're going to all agree to. And if somebody has an objection, let's talk about it now so that we don't have to, you know, get a couple sessions in and then someone says, I hate the way we're playing this game. This is the terriblest.
The terriblest.
The terriblest is a totally normal role-playing term. Fletcher, you have any things you like or dislike about 5th edition specifically?
You know, I mean, we talked about it earlier, but like the elimination of Thaco for earlier edition Dungeons & Dragons. And honestly, I haven't played too many other, like, I played some Shadowrun, but that was such a long time ago and such few sessions that like the rules and everything didn't stick into my head that well. So it's hard to compare to. It's hard for me to say. I do know that it's like, sometimes it's difficult with the amount of different dice that you have to be like, okay, what do I need to roll again? Like, is it a 1d20, you know, 2d8, you know, 4d6? Like, what am I rolling? I forget. Like, sometimes I wish there was just, like, one dice that could just, like, add plus or minus two or multiples of that. So,
yeah. The way I teach D&D is, here's a D20. Unless I say otherwise, this is the only die you're ever going to roll. And the only time you ever...
Yeah, D20 is pretty much all you're going to roll.
Yeah.
Unless
you're in combat. If you're doing damage, then you're going to roll something else. But you'll be told specifically. If you're ever said to make a roll, this is the one die you need to roll.
Yeah.
The one die to rule the ball. Unless you have an advantage here and then roll it twice. But otherwise, yeah.
Yeah, advantage, disadvantage. We have played around with that, house ruled it a few different ways, as I recall. That one is a kind of controversial, you know, choice of fifth edition from what I hear.
I wouldn't say it's actually... I think advantage and disadvantage, if you liked all the pluses and minuses that came from all over the place in Pathfinder and earlier editions of D&D, you know, you get a plus one from this and a plus two from that and a minus one over here, then you'd be disappointed with advantage and disadvantage. Because what advantage and disadvantage does is get rid of all of that fiddly math. You either have advantage, you don't have advantage, or you have disadvantage, or you don't have disadvantage. And if you have both advantage and disadvantage, they cancel out no matter how many stackings of one or the other you'd have. They just cancel each other out. And that's the whole system. It super streamlines it, but at the same time, it can simplify it to the point that some people don't like the oversimplification of it.
Yeah, because it can sometimes make it feel like somebody who's, you know, unskilled but in a good situation can do better than somebody who's very skilled in a normal situation because they get that advantage of the 2d20.
Yep. So, and there's a couple things that I don't like about 5th edition, but they're very minor, and I still think 5th edition is probably it's my favorite role-playing game to play, even though I really, really love Champions and the hero system and point buys and all of that. You'd spend 4 hours in a combat in Champions. It's very, very micro. They manage every single second. It's that detailed of a simulation. So, In 5th edition, one of the things I don't like is attributes are scaled from 3 to 18. So they're basically the value of 3d6. Roll 3 six-sided dice and add them all together. But then you turn that into a modifier, which essentially boils everything down to a negative 1 to a plus 4. And I just think that range is so small that it becomes inconsequential. So I do have some house rules that make the attribute a little bit more important because... Typically in 5th edition, the attribute value means nothing. It's the attribute modifier that matters. That's
true. Yeah, I was going to say, like, the thing that kills me sometimes is, like, when you upgrade, when you get to upgrade an attribute point, if you're on a even number. If you want to upgrade that, there's, like, no real gain to upgrading the even number. You have to essentially do it twice to, any benefit out of it. So it's like, do I want to waste this point this turn so I can get a plus one, like, at 4 levels from now? Or should I just go ahead and upgrade my wisdom from like 11 to 12?
Exactly.
That I don't really use that often, but it'll give me a plus one.
Yep. So I have a house rule that helps address that, where I, instead of everything being based off of the modifier, I base some things off of the kind of a half modifier. So saving throws, for example, will be based, if you have an odd numbered attribute, you'll get a plus one in your saving throws. So they're a step ahead of your skills as far as that's concerned, which means when you go from that 12 to 13, there is still a mechanical benefit somewhere on your character sheet that happens. And it's not just a lost or, you know, a investment wasted into your future. Right.
For now, wasted.
Yep. My other complaint about Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition is the skill system is a little bit too, I guess, abstract. But the problem I find with it is, since everything's based on a d20, if you're proficient in the skill, you get a plus 2 to it. But everyone has every skill. So I'm proficient. I've decided that this is a skill that my character is really good at. But really, it just gives me a 10% advantage over Joe somebody else with the same attribute score in there. And maybe I'm not even as good. If someone has a better attribute in that skill, I could be proficient in it, but they still may have a better role. So I try to, I do a little house rule with that as well. And essentially what I say is, if you're not proficient in the skill, you always have disadvantage with it. So what that does is, when you become proficient, you're not getting necessarily better at it, but everyone else is worse because they're not proficient. And that kind of makes you more important, because I am trained in survival. So I have a better chance than you because you're always going to start at disadvantage trying to figure out how to start a fire in the middle of the woods.
Right, like lock picking or something like that, where it's like, well, I just have a super high dexterity and I rolled well, as opposed to like
the dedicated thief.
A dedicated thief.
Yep. So, and these are things where, you know, this is a role-playing system. If you go strictly by the rules as written, it is what it is. But in order to make it more fun for me and my table, I make these very small tweaks that, to me, have a big impact. To my table, will have a big impact because I will, as a DM, I will emphasize these particular aspects of characters. Because one of the rules that I, when we're creating characters, is like no overlapping specialties. I don't want two characters that are really good at picking locks because they're always going to be overshadowing each other and it doesn't give the player a chance to stand out with their character. So these are things I kind of enforce when we're creating characters.
At least for long campaigns. This isn't for like organized play somewhere you're just showing up. You can't really, oh, you showed up with the wrong kind of character. Out of the table.
Also, it gives like the party a chance to like fail as a story point because it's another thing. I hate having parties of like, you know, six or eight people because there's so many overlapping that it's like, let me try. It's just like lemmings. Like, keep trying to like do something. It's like, oh, I succeeded. So like, basically the whole party succeeds if I succeed.
Is there aiding in 5th edition or is that just Pathfinder? Okay.
Nope, you can aid. You can aid. So basically what it does is if you spend your action to help someone else, that person has advantage on their action.
Okay. Because in Pathfinder, and probably 3.5 too, you get like a +2 for every successful aid. And that way, you know, if everyone in the party has the same thing, it's like, oh, I've got a +10 to this roll. It's like ridiculous.
Yep. And that's the thing with Pathfinder. You're trying to find that way to, I don't want to say break the system because it, I don't want to belittle the system, but it is a very, very mathematical system. And there are ways to min-max your character. Minimize the disadvantages, maximize the advantages of your character, that you can become incredibly super powerful. And there are certain builds that are just crazy, crazy powerful. And some people just love playing that.
So about 5 minutes ago, I said we could talk about this forever. And then we were going to move on, but we didn't.
All right. So we're going to quickly talk about, and not in any details, but licensed RPGs. So those things like, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game, the Star Trek role-playing game, which the name of the company is escaping me, but there's a new Star Trek role-playing game out there. Stargate.
Incredibly popular.
There's a Star Wars one from Fantasy Flight the Fantasy Flight Star Wars is three different role-playing games, depending on if you're playing, I think there's Scum and Villainy. There's like one where you're playing a Jedi and then one where you're playing the Rebellion or something. So there's six different factions sort of in the Star Wars universe. And depending on where you're playing in there, there's a different role-playing book for them. The systems are technically compatible, but if you're playing Jedi's versus, you know, Villainy, the power levels of the characters don't necessarily compare well. So it's kind of it's like, you know, running around with Luke Skywalker and the rest of you are, you know, powerless droids in some cases. So
Age of Rebellion, Edge of the Empire, Force and Destiny.
Yep. It looks like. So those are the three, and they're compatible systems. But they're kind of meant to be played in their own campaign worlds.
Yep.
Let's see. Stargate had one. I actually had the Stargate role-playing game because it was based on the TV series and it had a lot of cool content from the TV series. And I really liked Stargate. A lot of these role-playing games that are based on IPs, they're going to be based on a movie, a TV series, a book, or comics. And if the IP jumps mediums, the game itself probably doesn't, because usually the game is licensed from one different medium. The Firefly RPG is a good example of that. There's a couple different Firefly RPGs, one based on the movie and two based on the TV series. And then those licenses will jump around and stuff. I've never actually played a game in one of these worlds because I find it very difficult to come up with stories outside of the stories we know.
Yeah.
But I appreciate those games. Star Wars has a huge ability to be its own campaigns. You don't have to be in the main world. And Star Trek's kind of the same way.
Yeah. Star Wars, too, if you are a fan of the books, has such an extended world built up already that you can jump into different pockets of that and have, you know, some of these more recognizable fun characters show up as NPCs.
Well, and especially since those books aren't canon anymore, since Disney bought the franchise, like, you can, if you've read those books, chances are the people you're playing with haven't, so you have a source of all kinds of adventures.
If they're playing the Star Wars role-playing game, they might have.
But they also have a ton of adventures that go along with them. So if you want to play the Star Wars RPG, there are just countless numbers of adventures that Fantasy Flight puts out on a regular basis. And because the demand for role-playing games is similar to the demand for board games, which is, that to say, fairly low, a lot what Fantasy Flight has done is they do big print runs of their core books, but their adventures are print on demand. So if you want to like order an adventure from them, you can, and they just get printed as they are needed. They also have like character cards and things like that, which are player aids, which are also all print on demand. So they have a system set up where they don't have to invest a ton in physical product until someone actually wants to order it, and then they just print it and send it out to you. So, and it's amazing to me how many role-playing games continue to come out. If you look on Kickstarter, there are probably more role-playing games and role-playing game supplements than there are board games on Kickstarter. And they're usually more expensive. It's super, super crazy expensive to do these books and the art. And usually it's all the art and stuff involved. But I tried to do a search on Board Game Geek. So Board Game Geek has a role-playing offshoot of it. And I tried doing a search for all of the board games that were published in 2018 and 2019, and then all the role-playing games that were published in 2018 and 2019, and both sides maxed out at 5,000. So it's just a lot.
Man, we didn't even talk about Call of Cthulhu as I'm looking through all these other things. Man.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then the generic role-playing system. Yeah, the Call of Cthulhu. I think they're in 7th edition now for that one. Let's see. Actually, Jason Rodney sent in an email asking about the 7C Kickstarter. 7C is another role-playing game written by John Rick, which is basically, you know, seafaring stuff. There was some drama around that Kickstarter, as apparently it is getting fulfilled, but it made a ton of money, and for some reason they weren't able to fulfill it. So there's some drama there. I told him that I wasn't allowed to talk about Kickstarter anymore because Kitty said, no more Kickstarter, please.
We just can't fight about Kickstarter. We can talk because I also backed the Zorro role-playing game on Kickstarter, basically to show it to my mom and be like, hey, look, somebody besides you cares about Zorro.
I care about Zorro.
Oh, my gosh. I just
thought Zorro when for Halloween a few years.
Apparently, my mom dressed up as Zorro for like 6 years in a row or something. That's pretty funny.
I remember Zorro when I was a kid. I mean, I was a kid when Zorro was on, but it was fun watching when I was little. Man, it was like, what, late 60s, early 70s?
Yeah.
No, it was like in reruns, and because I think my mom watched it as a kid. My mom is older than you.
Yeah, I know I think there was a reboot at one point as well.
And then there's the Antonio Banderas, whatever his
name. Well, that was a movie, right?
Yeah.
That was a movie, yeah.
It was several movies, I believe.
It was a TV series at one point.
Yes. It started as a TV show.
All right.
I'm looking it up. I'm looking up so much today.
Let's get into some listener mail.
It first aired in 1957.
But first, back to Zorro talk.
Darn it, Kitty.
Now I'm done.
Moving on.
Done.
Fletcher has a beef to beef about. And
I have a beef to beef about?
And Tim, I'm sorry.
Okay. So Tim wrote in, and I'm going to butcher his last name, Shakar.
I'm going to say Shocker.
Shocker. So Tim was writing in, and he wrote an email, and it's basically how I'm addressed in the email is my beef. And he writes in, he basically says, like, Kitty, Chris, and Josh. I just got finished listening to episode 137, and then he talks about 137 and some other questions for Chris. My problem is that I am not Josh.
No, you're not.
My name is Fletcher, and I don't have a British accent. And
we're trying to get you one.
Yeah, I'm not as sophisticated as Josh was, and I get it that like there's a learning curve, and that Josh was on the podcast for a long, long time. But I'm not Josh. So for everyone wondering out there, my name is Fletcher. I'm usually the first person that says anything in the podcast when you turn it on.
And then you're quiet.
That part, yeah. When you hit play, usually you hear me speak. But yeah, So
I will say, Tim, we're only using it as an example because we've gotten, I don't know,
a dozen
emails. Tim is not the only one. There have been other people that keep writing in and referring to me as Josh. And for a while, it was fine when I first started because it was like, okay, they're listening to older episodes. They're not caught up. But now it's getting into a thing. I'm like, well, do people actually...
We're just going to start saying your name a lot.
Yeah.
So like, we're going to address you a Fletcher weird number of times. We'll pick up on it.
I'm sorry. My favorite one was sent in. Hi, Chris, Kitty, and American Josh. I forgot your name.
Yes.
So that was my favorite.
That one was a while ago. They called me American Josh, which is fine because I think I was only like two episodes in at that point in time. So, everyone out there, Fletcher is the
that's brooding one in the background. Got it.
Yeah.
All right, Kitty, what is your listener mail?
All right, my listener mail is from Trevor, and he wrote in about F-bombs. So he first says that his language is not always the cleanest, and when his son was around 4, he dropped an F-bomb, and when asked who told him, he said it was mommy. So
you can also refer to me as F-bombs if you want. I'll take that. Josh, no good. Fletcher or F-bombs, that'll work.
Yep. Way to bring it back. I like that.
So later in life, this same son was at the table. Trevor was running a game for his son and his son's friends. So he's 14 years old, his son, and it's a group of teenagers around the table running through a D&D adventure. And the kid rolls garbage and he drops an F-bomb. I'll go to a quote here. Silence fell over the crowd. They look from him to me in horror. Deep down, I'm still grateful for him keeping me out of the doghouse 10 years ago. So with my sternest dad face, I say, that language is not acceptable at the table. You get 3 disadvantages to be imposed by me whenever I choose. The next session, one of his teen buddies took over DMing, so they still haven't been used. As they say, train them up early, and they'll still end up just like you.
I love that. It's not, you know, no dollar jar or anything like that. It's like disadvantage.
Yep. Yeah, well, it only works at the table.
You know, I'm going to find a way of incorporating that into my parenting style in real life. It's like, nope, you have disadvantage on getting that toy today.
It's called losing privileges, and it's a big, you know, big one in my parenting repertoire. Today, player 3 lost his toy kitchen privileges after standing on top of it several times.
He's, what, 14 months now?
Yeah, and he can climb on top of his toy kitchen. It's really great.
He's really proud of it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Zachary's almost two and a half months now, and he's learning how to do naps, and now he is screaming for 2 reasons now. He can scream because he's just cranky and tired, or scream because he's hungry. And it's really hard to know which one it is, because I'm like, okay, you might be hungry, here's a bottle, and then he just screams and won't actually eat it. Okay, fine, go to sleep. And then he screams because he doesn't want to go to sleep. And then I put him to sleep and put a bottle. I put him in bed and put a bottle in there, and that works. So I'm like, okay, well, I hear that's bad because you don't want to put him to bed with a bottle all the time.
Nope.
Parenting.
Hard choices all the time. You got to take a hard move. You should stop rolling under 6.
Sounds like he's giving you disadvantage.
Oh, yeah, that's the best thing about knowing role-playing systems.
You get disadvantage on sleep for the next 2 years.
Tell me about it. I have to go back to work in a month, and I'm like, I just need him to sleep through the night by then. Come on, you can do it.
Oh,
you
just
can
wait.
Do it.
They'll start sleeping through the night, and then the fire detector starts chirping in the middle of the night. That was my night last night. It's like, quick, silence it before it wakes the child.
Speaking of parents, Tim writes in about cash grabs and starts with, because this is actually a good segue.
Oh.
He's like, my parents owned a traveling carnival. It was a family business since before I was born, the last couple of years. Let's see.
Until the my last parents, couple of years.
Yes. Until the last, and yeah, from before he was born to the last couple of years. He says, my parents spent their entire lives growing the business to where they eked out a decent living. And even then, the business model only worked because their employees made a terrible wage. Yet almost anyone who goes to their local fair complains about ride tickets, cotton candy, and carnival games costing way too much. The truth is, people just don't get it. It really is true. I think carnivals are kind of another one of those things of, it's a business of passion. You have to love doing it. And the people who work it love doing it, so they're willing to take lower wages to do it.
Carnies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I worked at a carnival. Well, there was two summers where I did like, I brought bouncy houses around for like corporate picnics and stuff. And like climbing up the rope ladder that spins you around and try to get the stuffed animal. And
your work history is so bizarre.
I've had at least over 40 different jobs in my life. I did a lot when I was a teenager. I got bored. I worked the same job for maybe 3 months and then move on to something completely different because I liked learning new things. He continues, though. As for any board game money grabs, I think the only real examples are big companies slapping on pointless IP skins to games that don't need it to make money, don't need to be made in the first place. So slapping on IPs on games that don't need to be made in the first place. And he uses the million different versions of Monopoly as an example. What do you guys think about that?
I agree.
So you think? I still don't agree because, I mean, like, it's still Monopoly. And if you want to buy, like, the Star Wars version of Monopoly or the San Francisco version of Monopoly because, you know, you love Star Wars or you live in San Francisco or whatever, like, I don't want to call that, like, a money grab, but, like, it is kind of like a collector's thing and there's probably a lot fewer of them and you still don't have to buy it if you don't want to. Just like the popcorn at the Carney Festival. Like,
Carney even it, Festival?
Or, you know,
Carnival.
Sorry, Carnival.
There you go.
Like the popcorn like at the Carney Carnival. Festival. Carney Festival sounds like, you know, it's like a Russian nesting doll of like carnies at a carnival.
Yeah, I will say, I don't know if it's, if this is a cash grab, then I would say that many niche businesses would be such a thing. I really think it's just a matter of it is a business model. It works for them. And people outside of that may not appreciate that business model, but it's sort of like Beanie Babies. Like, are Beanie Babies worth, you know, what they're worth? Maybe. Are they like just making 100 a year? Is that a great thing for the world? Probably not. But if it's making them money, then it's a successful business. I think honestly, you know, Coke and Pepsi and Doritos, like these are worse because these are creating things that are actually detrimental to society.
You
but they
your
make
mouth.
A fortune.
Doritos are God.
I love Doritos. I love Doritos and I love Diet Coke. Doesn't mean so that good. It's not good for me. It's just, it is a way, it's a company business model, you know? And Monopoly does a lot less harm than Doritos, I think.
Depends on who you're talking
Bold
about.
Stance.
Harming people's health, maybe. Harming the planet. Monopoly uses up a lot more, you know, resources than making a bag of Doritos. I don't
Does
know.
It? Does it?
How many plastic bits are in a bag of Doritos?
How many bags of Doritos are there compared to Monopoly bits?
Yeah. But I don't know.
Well, anyway.
I don't have the numbers.
To end on a more positive note, Tim had dedicated to paint his board gaming collection, and he sent me a picture of his progress so far. He sent me a picture of about 30 Rum and Bones figures that were mostly done. Not quite completed, but a really good start. So, Tim, keep it going. He did mention that he's not going as fast as he thought he would, but he's still doing better than me. I haven't painted a single figure since I went on paternity leave, and it's making me sad.
Yeah, it's like your hands are busy doing other things.
All right, speaking of board games, though, next week is our 140th episode. We will be doing our last episode on role-playing games for a little while. Specifically, we're going to be doing an episode on role-playing games and media, so how they're represented in the media, places to watch them, things like that. But we are also going to do a drawing for Wanderer, the Cult of Barnacle Bay Kickstarter. So this includes the Kickstarter exclusive figures, an extra set of dice, a set of young version of the hero cards, basically all the Kickstarter stuff. And I wanted to do this when we hit 65 Patreon backers. We didn't quite make it, but I did set 140 as our limit on there. So if you would like to help us get to that 65 number on Patreon and so have the drawing be next week, now's your chance. Go out, go to Patreon. It's only $2, $2, and you'll get all kinds of extra content that we've been putting up there. We have longer, Kitty and I were continued debating about Kickstarter for a little while, and I just happened to hit record at the end of one of the episodes. Put that up there. We have a couple episodes on KittyForge that we put up there. We will be putting something really cool up there in the next couple weeks that will eventually make it into the public, but you will hear it first there. And as soon as we get back into our regular Sunday night schedule, I swear to God, we're going to put something as a live stream on so that our patrons can be part of the recording if they want to be.
We had technical difficulties for a while there, but
yeah, I think I've ironed out those. Now it's just a matter of setting a time and sticking to it. So that is next week. And oh, how do you enter that? It's very, very simple. If you've ever sent us an email, if you've ever posted an input thread or a feedback thread on BoardGameGeek, within the last basically 4 or 5 weeks, you're automatically entered. So I just go through, I grab all the usernames from BGG, I grab all of the email addresses from our email account, I grab everything from the Patreon. So if you're a patron, you're automatically entered because I grab all the Patreon names. I throw them into a Google Doc. It randomly generates a number and says, this person's the winner. And that's how you get entered. So there's nothing special to do. If you don't want to give us feedback, just email me saying, hey, I have nothing to say to you. You're awesome. Enter me in the contest.
I have nothing to say to you except free stuff.
That works. That totally works. And let's see. I think that's pretty much all. Kitty, you are definitely not going to Origins this year, right?
I will not be at Origins this year.
All right. And Fletcher, you won't be at Gen Con. Are you thinking Origins?
I don't think I'm going to be able to make any of them this year because wedding stuff.
All right. Well, maybe Game Hole Con, October 31st through the 3rd. Put that on your calendar. That one's a fun one. But those are our next conventions. Origin, Gen Con, Game Hole Con. We will be at Gaming Hoopla too if you're in the Mundelein area of North suburbs of Chicago. That's on April 26th to the 28th. But Origins, Gen Con, and Game Hole Con, those are our big conventions for the rest of the year. And let's see, if you would like to follow us, you can follow us on Facebook at @TabletopGameTalkPodcast, Twitter at @TabletopGameTLK, Kitty is Lawful Good Mom, Fletcher is Net Fletch, I am Game Master Chris. Leave us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, which I will always call iTunes because Apple Podcasts is a mouthful. Unless you're from Apple and I offend you, then it's Apple Podcast, aka iTunes. You can support us on Patreon by going to tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Or go to Patreon and search for Tabletop Game Talk.
Tabletop Game Talk is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. Thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So email us with comments or questions about today's topic at feedback@tabletopgametalk.com. Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons. George, Adam Harrison, the SGC, Thomas Acciaretti, Jason Strong, Terrence Miltner, Stephen Seitz, Michael Ohl, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, C. Marie, Rudy Liu, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Wang, Stefan Phillips, Caleb O'Brien,
Jennifer Engelbrett, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, David Radke, Nick Quickstra, David Sellers, Jason Rodney, Michael Yanikowski, Miles Clark, Sydney Lum, Phil Schwartzel, Ann Reynolds, Eric Hoffman, Adrian Dong,
Christopher Vincent, Nate, Baz Flintham, Sean Peck, Eric Silander, Mike Smith, Trevor Davis, Wesley Trailer, Tim Verning, Chris Lowe, Joe Hoover, Timothy Gross, Glenn Cotter, Jesse Wolkowiak, Barry Peterson, Ben Gary, Emil Jewel Jacobson, Marina Stevens, Brady Meltzer, Gregory Huber, John Gilstrap, and Stephen Judd as Chris violently tries to enter at the very end in real time what I'm saying.
Until next week, keep playing games and having fun.
The terrible weather yesterday.
Oh my gosh, it's so much snow. Yeah.
There was a blizzard. It was
Sunday.
It was April 14th. We're not in the Great North and we're in Wisconsin, but geez, there was a foot of snow. Like, I think we got literally 10 inches of snow. And then today it's like 60 degrees gone. And it's all gone.
Yeah, it was really weird. In the city, we got like 6 inches of snow, but I was like, I had plans to go out and meet up with friends, and I'm like, I'm not leaving. This is terrible.
Yeah. And it was wet and it was gross. And I'm like, oh, I should probably shovel the sidewalk, except for, oh, wait, I don't need to because the ground was so warm, it just melted on the sidewalk. And it's just going to melt tomorrow anyway. So, yeah, I just boycotted the snow
outdoors in general. Yeah.
All right.